Hello and welcome to episode 77 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. And there is me, Nigel Poulton, Lauren Malhoit. Hello, Lauren.
Hello, Nigel. How's it going?
It's good, yeah. Mark Farley. Woo-hoo.
Oh, I have no beer bottle props today.
But you know what? We do have a guest. So we've got Joe Onosik on.
Hey.
Hey. We do, yeah. Lauren, actually, just before we do introduce Joe, is Joe your boss or is he your boss's boss or something?
Yep. Joe is my direct boss, unfortunately.
Does this mean you're going to be on like super special behavior or something?
No, Joe doesn't like that. I actually act worse when I'm around Joe.
That should be good then. So, hello, Joe. Thank you for being on the podcast. Do you want to just tell everybody who you are and where we can find you on like the Twitters and stuff like that?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. I'm Joe Onosik. You can find me on Twitter at J-O-N-I-S-I-C-K. And I'm currently a principal engineer for Cisco, focusing on our software-defined networking and hybrid cloud strategies.
Cool. Can I just ask you a question? What's it like managing Lauren?
Well, when she's not acting on her best behavior, she's pretty likable and she does what I want. But it's when she tries to be too corporate cookie cutter that she gets really annoying.
I cannot believe Lauren is ever like that. Lauren, flip the question, right? So what's it like having Joe as your boss?
When he's not being horrible and gives me a good atta girl, you know, once a year or so, it's pretty great.
I'm doing that too often, obviously.
Yeah.
This is like the touchy-feely show. I mean, that's and right. Nigel, what's it like having Nigel as a host for the show?
Yeah, Yeah. Mark bosses me on the podcast, so yeah.
Actually, it's a disaster without him, though.
Mark, you're the boss of the podcast these days, actually, aren't you? You're doing the edits. Just let everybody know that at the moment. Everybody that does tune in and listen to the podcast. We've all got Mark to thank recently, so yeah, you're the boss, Mark.
Yeah, that's right. I get to remake the content in my own image.
Make us sound like fools and you sound like the business, yeah?
That's right.
So if we can all kind of club together and make this as much of a farce as possible and give Mark like a 5-hour editing job, that'd be payback for the 50 edits I've done and the 20 edits Hans has done in the past. Yeah,
I did one.
Did you? You did. Never mind. Anyway, let me run through the agenda that we've got, because for once we do have somewhat of an agenda. So if I say technology news right now, I think these are pretty interesting, right? Microsoft announces SQL Server 2016, wait for it, for Linux. Holy cow. As well, Microsoft announces Azure Cloud Switch. So, I'm not like a networking guy or anything, but switching software for white box, like open compute platform or project, yeah, switching gear. But again, that's only gone and been based on, is it Debian Linux? So I don't know, right? Somebody check whether hell's freezing over or not, but it really seems like Microsoft, look, they've been kind of cozying up to Linux for a while, and I do want to talk about this in a second. I wonder if the writing is on the wall for Windows as like a server operating system in the future. Anyway, never mind, we will come back to that. Also under tech news, Cisco announces new switching, so hardware and software, somebody tell me if I'm wrong on this, right? 25 gig and 100 gig. Like, I've heard of 40 gig and 100 gig, but I mean, I'm opening myself up to be embarrassed in front of our hundreds of thousands of listeners here, right? But I'd never even heard of 25 gig switching. Is that like a real kosher thing?
Absolutely. So not just 25, 50 and 100. And honestly, that is a result of Microsoft demands and chipset design that was already existing.
Really? See, I find it quite interesting, and I'm been pulled off piste a little bit here, right? But the Fibre Channel guys, and I don't know whether they're all just like old curmudgeons or whatever, but they seem to stick with like computer numbers, you know, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and then we talked last week like 128's coming. But then in like the Ethernet world, it's like, well, it's a free-for-all, isn't it? There's like 10 gig, 40 gig, 50 gig, 100 gig, 25 gig. What's with that?
What ended up happening is you had companies like Microsoft that in certain cases were already going to leapfrog the bandwidth requirements for 10 gig at the server access layer. So they needed something more. 40 gig right now, cost points are just atrocious if you're talking about connecting each server at 40 gig. So they did some smart things, and kind of the history lesson here was they looked at the 100 gig standards, and the way we were all building our chips for 100 gigs was by combining 4 25 gig lanes into 100 gig port. So basically they said, why don't you split these out? Give me 25, 50, and 100 gig options. And they got a consortium of other companies to get together and build an off-standard standard for that. And they've really actually kind of help the market quite a bit, because I can ship you today 25 gig ports at the price of 10 gig ports and 140, 50, 100 gig ports at the price of 40 gig ports.
And now you'll be able to get an operating system upgrade piped over the internet, and it'll only take a day and it doesn't cost very much.
You know what? My last Windows upgrade was 8 gig. 8 freaking gig. Oh, actually.
That's why they need the bandwidth.
That's why, yeah. Well, you know what? Necessity drives innovation, right?
Hey, that's not that bad. I think my last Destiny update on the PlayStation 4 was 8 gig.
Right, fair play. Hey, so let me get back on piste real quick, right? So that was the tech news. In business news, I don't know whether Lauren and Joe, maybe you won't be able to talk about this, and if you can't, Mark and I will, but there's been a lot of talk in the press this week about Cisco apparently trying to acquire Nutanix and Simplivity before they ended up partnering with SpringPath, and there have been some numbers bandied around as well, so we might come back to that one. Acquisitions and startups. FlashGrid, a new startup looking to bring software-defined flash storage to the world of Oracle databases. And finally, Docker Inc. acquires a company I've never heard of called Conductant for an undisclosed fee, as it looks to deliver orchestration at the largest kinds of scales in the container world. So that's kind of our agenda. Now, if nobody minds, I really want to talk about this Microsoft stuff first up, right? I know back in the day, there are all these famous quotes about Steve Ballmer, and he was probably talking about the GPL license rather than Linux, but he was, you know, famously quoted like 15 years ago or whatever it was, now we're saying Linux is a cancer. We all know that Satya Nadella is cut from different cloth to Steve Ballmer, right? You know, you agree, Mark, right?
Yeah, totally.
But Microsoft is transforming into this company that even just 5 years ago, I personally wouldn't have believed it could. And it's still got a long way to go, okay, right? But if we think about it, right, Linux is already a first-class citizen on the Azure cloud platform. I think the latest numbers are something like 25% of all workloads in Azure are Linux, which is a decent number. They've open sourced .NET, and I believe that is also available on the Linux platform as well. Now they're bringing SQL Server 2016 to the Linux platform. Now, of course, it's a pre-announcement, and you know it's not going to be available until next year, 2016. But then they've got this SONiC thing, so Software Switching for Open Networking in the Cloud. That's the acronym there. But it's this like switching software for white box switching, if my understanding's right. And it's based on Linux. Obviously, I don't think the death knell is totally sounding for Windows as an operating system. But I just wonder, and I'm really keen on people's input on this, right, is like Linux seems to almost be the go-to or de facto platform for cloud computing. Is the writing on the wall for Windows and its long-term future in the data center? I'm not saying it's going to go away in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. But are we going to see it kind of ramp down? And do we think that Microsoft is seeing that as a trend? And is that like where they're going with all of this stuff?
Maybe once they put Active Directory on Linux, then we'll see it. But I think we still have Active Directory to hold on to.
I totally get that, Lauren. But if that was the only thing that you were deploying Windows for in your environment and all of like your databases and heck, look, who's deploying on-premises Exchange these days, right? People are looking for alternative email solutions. So that's one of the old on-premises data center mainstays that's kind of eroding away. I don't know. I really do think I see a bigger picture here, but I might be smoking something.
I don't know. I think it's a smart move, regardless of whether the writing's on the wall for the OS. The OS is a fairly commodity right now, Linux being the dominant one. The application's really what sells and what has the stickiness to the customer base. Giving more accessibility to the application across more platforms, I think, is a smart move to Microsoft and opening it up to get that traction with the applications, the databases, whatever they want to put out there going in the future, I think is the right move for them to be doing.
And as cloud becomes more and more prevalent in our lives, you know, I think Linux is a little more agile in the cloud and it's going that way. So I totally agree with Joe here that it's probably good for them, for the application itself to be covered there.
Got any thoughts on it, Mark?
They should have just split that company up years ago. I mean, when the Department of Justice, you know, had the investigation and they looked at monopolistic practices, and they said it's not good for the customer, you know, to have a vendor, you know, providing, you know, basically the de facto desktop and a large part of the server operating systems as well as all of the applications. Initially, it was going to be split up, and then there was an appeal, and Microsoft was allowed to keep it together. It would have been in their own best interest to have it split up. I think that probably over the years, and with Ballmer's leadership, is that there was so much concern about trying to keep all of this stuff together that it really hampered, I think, the growth of Windows or the flexibility of Windows. It became the thing, you know, that everything else ran on. You look at the sequence of releases that Microsoft has had with Windows. You know, they've had some real clunkers in there, and I don't think, and you know, just terrible freaking systems, right? And that never would have happened, I think, if the operating system had been forced to live on its own. And in the cloud, where everything runs on Linux, your apps better run with Linux, and they better run really well. Thing that Nadella said, you know, that they wanted to do, but I don't think they're going to be able to do it. They were trying to make Windows work as a cloud operating system. It's like, well, we're going to be cloud first, we're going to be mobile first, or we're going to be those two things. And it's like, okay, so what does that mean? What do people want to use? Does the operating system matter that much? No, not really. The apps are what matters. The apps are what people use. So I think they're being an app first company, and that means that Windows is kind of taking it on the chin.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think for years the operating system profits have been an anchor to their ability to move into the cloud and the app world, and now they're getting rid of that anchor and decoupling the two. It's a brilliant move.
Let's not forget about Nigel's super sexy Surface book, though.
Oh, my Surface book.
Surface.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't care.
Surface as a service.
Yeah. So I don't care if Windows dies within the data center, but holy cow, like, I love Windows 10, and yeah, my super sexy Surface Book. I would be pretty good. I mean, because, look, I'm quite a fan of Linux, but it sucks on the desktop, I'll be honest about that. That's personal opinion, right? But it's a server operating system, and yeah, pretty clunky on the desktop. But Mark, you know what? Obviously, you've spent time inside of Microsoft as an employee. It's one thing to be like an app-first company, right, and cloud-first and all of that, and I get where they're going, and I totally agree that these kind of moves really do seem to be good moves for them. Do you have a feel, though, for within Microsoft as an organization, does the Windows team, does it translate, but do they rule the roost? You know, are they still like king of the hill inside of the company, and are there internal politics and things that you see that might hold them back?
Yeah, there's always a lot of internal politics. There's graphics that show relationships between different types of companies, right? And I you know, there was one for Oracle and one for, I can't remember if it was Cisco or IBM. But the one for Microsoft, there were these people enshrouded by clouds, and there were like three different business groups, and they're all pointing pistols at each other. And it's hilarious because there's always been that sort of rift or difference, and fairly intense difference between the different business groups at Microsoft. And they don't necessarily get along that well. And I think what you're seeing now is the apps people have the upper hand. A lot of the people from the Windows Server group have been transitioned into cloud. And a large part of the SQL development has been transferred into cloud stuff. I don't know what it's like now, but my guess is that it's not just Azure, but it's cloud in general. You know, they need to make this stuff work on AWS as well as everywhere else. And I expect that actually there's fewer people working on Windows Server than there ever needed to be. And Windows Server is a strange product anyway. I mean, it's a catch-all for all of this stuff. All the storage products that they have, all the networking products that they have, the database products they have. You look at this vast array of stuff, and it's all sold as part. Well, not all sold. SQL's different, but all this, you know, the networking and storage stuff for sure is all sold as things that come with Windows Server, and it's damn near impossible for them to extract the value out of that stuff. And that's because all of these different features in Windows Server and in another company, they would have separate tracking numbers for it, or part numbers, and they would know revenue streams, and they would, and not that Microsoft doesn't track how this stuff is used, because they do to a degree, but they are unable to staff to support these different functions in the market. And a really interesting one to look at, for instance, is Hyper-V. Hyper-V is part of Windows Server, and it's like, okay, so that could be a hypervisor. It could be sold separately, but it's part of Windows Server. Microsoft has a very difficult time staffing sales, support, and marketing because Hyper-V doesn't have its own revenue stream. It doesn't have its own business unit behind it also. You can say the same thing for storage and the same thing for networking. And so it's been very hard for Microsoft to make hay in the market with all the features that are in Windows Server because it's just a one-size-catch-all type of product. And that has not helped it. And it hasn't helped it internally. So it's this big product that's not really taking off or going anywhere. And you would think with all the cloud stuff that's going on, they were sort of hoping that Windows Server would be this instrument for doing it, but it's not. It's getting beat to death by Linux. Maybe the answer is that Windows will survive on the desktop, but Windows Server, what's going to happen to that? I think sales are flat or probably even declining. What's that mean for a company like Microsoft? Can they afford to continue to keep it going? I think we're seeing some of the answer in what Microsoft is doing now.
So if I can summarize, I think in general, all of us think that Microsoft are heading probably in the right direction. They seem to be getting it right with Azure, and they seem to be getting it right that generally speaking, in the like the wider picture of things, the application is where all of the value is. And that, of course, that I'm not saying the application hasn't driven value in the past for Microsoft, like the Office Group and people like that have, you know, no doubt printed cash. But Windows was always like, well, was a big cash cow before and was like one of the major business units. And we're seeing a real pivot there. So we think that Satya is doing a good job kind of trying to turn the oil tanker around. Like, wild question, right? We did talk about them being like this one big company and potentially the issue of would they have been broken up in the past. Do we think breaking them up like an HP, HPE type thing might be the next step to make them a little bit more agile and a little bit more laser focused for the world of the cloud?
That's a great question.
Well, does it lead to, I mean, Mark, you kind of said that if they had done that years ago, that may have been a great thing. But now if they do that, does that leave them without maybe the guidance or influence of Nadella or the cloud team in general?
It's a very interesting thing to ponder, right? I mean, even if you take Windows 10 out, you know, which they're giving away, you know, they're continuing to give away.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, here's a cool question for you. If they were to slice and dice Microsoft, right, and you were to be the CEO of one of the business units, which business unit would you pick right now?
The app one, for sure. I mean, Office, probably.
Yeah, okay, that's your call. Lauren, which one would you pick?
I mean, cloud, probably. But I'm interested in hearing Joe.
I'd be all over Azure.
Yeah, I think that's me too as well. Interesting, none of us picked mobile. There you go.
I think that's it. That's like, is he serious? Maybe it's different in the UK.
Yeah, well, I know, yeah. But I think so, three of us are picking cloud there. So interesting. Anyway, so we talked a lot about Microsoft. We did talk about this Cisco thing earlier on, and the different like network speeds and stuff like that. But can either you, Lauren, or Joe just give us the skinny on what this latest announcement is?
I'll let Joe do it. Yeah, I think he's polished.
Righto. Hey, we don't want polished.
Joe, are you polished right now?
As polished as Joe gets.
So basically, we announced that for the next 2 years, we have the best frickin' switch you can buy in the data center, if that's polished enough for you.
That's how we like to roll. I like that. Is it anything major and interesting, or is it just like a step change in what you've had before?
From a, you know, speeds and feeds at cost perspective, it's pretty game changing. I mean, talking about buying that much density, that much port bandwidth at that cost, it's basically priced at the same point as white box switches, but you get a Cisco logo, a Cisco OS, and, you know, five times the speed you would off that white box. It's not a game changer, right? Because it's a speeds and feeds increase, but it's a pretty impressive speeds and feeds increase, I'd say. I think anything close to game changing that comes into that box is stuff that's yet to be announced. But over the next 60 days, you're going to hear us talking a lot about line rate data center analytics that is enabled by some of the stuff we baked into the ASICs or the chipsets on that box.
Hey, here's a question. Is white box switching in general something that is like looming large on the radar at Cisco these days?
So I'm going to speak a little theoretically to answer that one safely from a legal perspective. But if you look at it, take white box, I think really is a commodity cost play for most people. And then, you know, some of its flexibility, choose your own OS. If you look at where Cisco is today, take our 9000 platform, the data center platform where the announcements were made. That platform already has an option within Cisco for two different operating systems, which means we've already done the engineering work to disaggregate the OS from the switch hardware. We also have all merchant silicon platforms, which is what Whitebox is built on. So we have boxes in our Nexus 3000 line that only use Broadcom. Because we've done the disaggregation and because we've engineered boxes that all only use merchant, we could theoretically at any point turn the switch to sell a customer a piece of hardware without an OS, an OS without a piece of hardware, if the industry was really trending that way. So from the way I look at it, I don't consider it that big of a looming threat because of the what we can build into our switches today and the cost points we can give it. but we've already done the engineering work that if that, I guess, catches us off guard, all we really have to do is flip a switch and take the risk on a business model, which in some ways would cannibalize pieces of our business, but it'd give customers, if that's the flexibility they demand, it'd give them that flexibility.
Okay, cool. Appreciate that. I'm not going to dwell on it too much because I appreciate it is, you know, you and Lauren do work for Cisco. That's where the paycheck comes from. And you don't obviously speak officially for them on this podcast and stuff like that, right? So let me just switch tack a bit. I am going to stick with Cisco, but I'm going to just fire this question really to Mark and we'll have like a quick discussion on it. But we talked last week on the podcast about the partnership with SpringPath and Cisco, okay? Whenever something like this happens, it's inevitable that people from the channel, you know, make anonymous comments and things like that saying, well, it's all well and good Cisco saying this and how it's game-changing and it's going to leapfrog Nutanix and people like that. But what they're not telling you, and, you know, I'm quoting without making formal quotes here, but just articles I've read this week saying within the last year, Cisco have approached Nutanix, and I've heard the number $4 billion thrown out there. And I'm thinking for a company that's raised in the region of $320, $350 million, and somebody has approached, Cisco has apparently approached them and said, we'll give you $4 billion to buy you out, to acquire you. And they've said, no, thanks. I'm like, really? But also rumors that they'd approached Simplivity as well. And if any of that is true, and I'm after your feedback here, Mark, is this kind of, I don't know, I'm starting to see almost a trend that a lot of companies these days are saying they come to market with this new announcement, we've partnered with somebody or we've acquired somebody, and it is the best thing in the world, obviously, and it like wipes the floor with everybody else. But actually, we're only partnering with them or we're only buying them or whatever because we tried to buy XYZ technology and they knocked us back. So I don't know, what are your thoughts, Mark, on whether or not, well, here's a question, right? If Cisco did, or if anybody offered Nutanix $4 billion to acquire them, based on the fact that they've only raised, like, I think probably a little bit shy of $350 million, would they have been crazy to have turned that down?
Are you crazy to turn down $4 billion?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Except this, that if they were looking to get a higher multiple on their investment, rather than a 10x, if they were hoping to get like a 20x or 25x, that $3 billion didn't make it, right? And Cisco needs to look at this. And, you know, these are calculated guesses that companies make, right? What is my make versus buy on this, right? And does it make sense to spend more than, say, $4 billion or $5 billion, right? So let's just say that the discussion went along and maybe, you know, a number was put forth of $4 billion. You know, Nutanix was flying very high a year ago, right? I mean, it just seemed like the next inevitable thing, right? The biggest unicorn in the IT space. And they probably thought, well, that's, you know, we'd actually like to see this more like $7 billion. We think that it's worth more of where Nasira went out than it is what you're offering us now. And if you get an offer like this, believe me, it's not just the CEO and the people at Nutanix. It's the whole board.
Yeah.
You know, everybody involved. Look at this. You have to talk about it, right? And you are obliged to have these kinds of meetings. And my guess is that, you know, if that offer was made, the Nutanix board came back and said something like either no or here's a different number, right? And then Cisco has to look at that and say, okay, so we've already been doing our make versus buy. We don't know that there actually is enough intellectual property here, because with that amount of money, we can actually make a lot of our own business and do this ourselves or find another partner, whatever they want to do. And so if those discussions took place and Cisco's offer was rejected, you know, before they made that offer, they already had a pretty good idea of what they were going to do if Nutanix said no.
So do you think if the offer was to come in now, the same offer, and this is all, we're just, you know, theorizing here, nobody's officially saying any offer for $4 billion was made, but if it was to be made now, considering market conditions, considering the numbers that we've seen from Nutanix, from their S1 filing and things like that, do you think they would accept it now?
It's possible.
I think they would, because
the one that I can't figure out is Simplivity. Why didn't Simplivity do it? I mean, do they think they're worth that much too? And that makes me think that actually that offer probably was not made.
So
I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't read any numbers around what was offered for Simplivity. All I've read is a couple of articles citing.
And remember, they are rumors, though. I mean, it's rumors. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, of course.
This is all conjecture.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
You know, there might have been an offer made. There might not have. There might have been an unofficial, you know, offer made where they were just talking about it, but without, you know, a formal presentation, you know, that might have been done. You know, there's a lot of ways that this can go, Nigel. So we shouldn't assume too much anyway.
No, it's okay. And you're right. We shouldn't assume too much. I don't have numbers to hand, but I know we've talked about this in the past, right, that the whole, like, hyper-converged market at the moment is not, like, a massive market. So I know the kind of number, if any offer ever was made in the region of something like $4 billion. If you compare that to the size of the actual hyper-converged market as Gartner had it, like, $4 billion is massive. I don't know how much credence I give to those stories, actually, because the number just, to me, right, and I know I don't sit on the boards of any of these companies, but it just seems like this outlandishly massive number that I can't even comprehend, and people are knocking it back, apparently, just kind of blows my mind.
With no knowledge of the subject, I would say that it would not surprise me at all for something, an offer like that, to be made prior to the Simplivity announcement and our hyperconverged strategy. To make an offer on a company, you have already decided you need to enter that space. If the company is asking for more money than you want, you're not going to back out of the space. You're going to find another way to enter that space. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this theoretically may have happened. But $4 billion does, to Nigel's point, sound like an extremely high number for the total market share or addressable market within hyperconverged, with as many players that are already fighting over it.
Compared to what Cisco actually paid for SpringPath, I mean, $4 billion is, you know, just extraordinarily a lot more.
I know, numbers like that keep making me think, I really need to start getting into the startup business. But, of course, that's my ridiculous rose-tinted glasses that realizes that, like, 999 out of every 1,000 startups fails miserably.
Sometimes you buy another company that's got such a large install base, mm-hmm. that there's value in that. That's not the case here.
No, I agree. I tell you what. Well, we did talk last week saying that one of the strengths of the Cisco SpringPath thing going forward is going to be the fact that, you know, obviously this is going to be a quote-unquote hyper-converged solution that actually does proper networking, right? That simplifies the networking and isn't, you know, like a storage heavy play. And I think one of the challenges that Nutanix and other people have is that when they go into an organization, they sell this kind of obviously hyper-converged shrink-wrapped solution that you can drop on the data center floor, tear the wrapping off, plug it into the power, and it's up and working, minus the one small caveat that you've got to plug it into the network, right? And I do think that, generally speaking, that kind of takes the gloss off something like Nutanix. Don't get me wrong, I'm not having a pop at Nutanix here. I kind of like what they do from the technology perspective. But I know that quite often people find it hard operationally to get it up and running as fast as they had maybe hoped they would in the first place. Because just plugging something like this into the network is, in a lot of organizations, is non-trivial, right? So if Cisco had acquired somebody like Nutanix, who's already got like this fully baked stack minus the networking side of it, I know it's not minus the networking side, right? But it's kind of minus the big player Cisco networking that most organizations would look at and say, all right, it's XYZ model of Cisco switch, right? Yeah, we can just plug that straight in. We can apply policies and stuff to it. That would potentially have been a great buy, I think, for Nutanix to, you know, say, we've now got a proper full-on hyperconverged solution that includes proper data center switching in there, yeah?
HCI less N.
Absolutely, yeah. Anyway, so let's shift on to acquisitions and startups, right? FlashGrid, a startup who, I believe they're a new player. I couldn't find any information on Crunchbase about them, but it appears they're looking to deliver software-defined flash storage for the Oracle database world. Now, we very rarely have anything good to say about Oracle on the podcast, but I did think when I was looking into this, right, because our other news item under acquisitions and startups is Docker-related, right? And one of the things that we come back to time and time again about Docker is, you know, look, loads of mindshare out there, cool technology, driving like innovation and all that kind of stuff, but a little bit uncertain on where the business model is, yeah? Whereas you look at FlashGrid, right, and these guys If we take the technology away just for a second, they are square in with a proper business plan here. You know, it's like, right, enterprise Oracle workloads, we're going to deliver this for you, and right out of the gate, you're going to pay us for it. Okay, we're hitting enterprises that we know have got deep pockets, that we know have got Oracle, that we know performance challenges, generally speaking, around, not that Oracle doesn't perform well, but that, you know, companies are always looking to squeeze more performance out. So, you know, I don't know a great deal about what they're looking to offer here as a technology, but from a business perspective, it seems like, I don't know, they're maybe onto something interesting here. I don't know, Mark, obviously you've been at a lot of storage startups and what have you in the past, whether you have any thoughts around what they're trying to achieve here.
Well, it's a software only play. So, you know, it will run on, it will run on some set of servers with flashcards and all of that. And you build the hardware yourself.
Do you think partnering up or trying to play in that space with a company like Oracle, who have obviously got their own flash-based products that they look to squeeze into customers, is this a great space to go for? Is it, you know, if you were, open to anybody right here, if you were looking for a software-based storage startup, would you look into the Oracle space? You know, do you think they're a good company to play with, or is it like dancing with the devil?
I think I'd throw that question at Mark. You used, Nigel, the term laser focused. I feel like going after that small a segment, maybe they're too, well, not a small segment, but maybe they're too laser focused. Okay. Does anyone really want a storage platform that's designed for one storage workload in their, you know, storage portfolio?
That's a good question, actually, because a lot of the successful like flash players in the market, like the likes of Pure and SolidFire and people like that, are all very general purpose, really, aren't they?
Yeah, the last thing I want to do is manage a different storage platform for every application I choose to use.
I was also making the comparison to like GridStore, which does what all Hyper-V, hyperconvergence or Hyper-V storage or whatever it is. I don't remember. But
GridStore is much, much broader, and it's a hardware software solution. It's mm-hmm. both pieces. You know, here you've got to pick your own stuff. And I just don't see why you're going to cut back in this way on storage for it, where, yeah, do you think Oracle will support this? I don't think so. No, there's no way. I think this company is stillborn.
Gosh, yeah. I think your point.
I wouldn't want to start an apparel manufacturer who's focused on great grandmothers under 60, right? Sometimes focus is you can get a little too focused.
Yeah.
Nice, Joe.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, but that's a really good point you make there, Mark. Actually, the support side of things, because Oracle does tend to run business critical line of business workloads. And you generally are going to be wanting a fully supported stack there. Now, I know that maybe VMware was a bit of an odd exception in that, like, for the longest time, Oracle formally wouldn't support you running it on VMware. In fact, actually, you know what? I'm not even certain whether they do today. Maybe they do.
I'm pretty sure they still don't.
Right. Okay. But that's like VMware was such like a pervasive movement in the market and what have you. We're certainly not expecting the similar kind of juggernaut from FlashGrid here. That's like a big hole in the business plan almost there. If that's not going to be supported, I don't see many like enterprise grade customers lining up to throw something that's not supported and something that, let's be fair, is as critical as storage, because when storage goes wrong, it goes wrong in style usually.
People just are not going to roll the dice on homemade crap.
No. And not that we're saying it is that, of course, but
companies will spend a lot of time and engineering resources trying to figure out how to qualify systems to run this on. Why would you think you could build this yourself, right? If you're John Twigo, maybe you think you can, right? But John Twigo's not getting hired to help people run their enterprise Oracle.
No.
Mark, with your background in, you know, storage startups, I would say that the enterprise Oracle environment is probably the hardest place to sell storage that doesn't have an EMC, HP, IBM, or NetApp logo.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you pretty much have to have a partnership there, you know, and so, you know, companies in the storage business always would partner with Oracle, and Oracle would, you know, partner, you know, willingly or reluctantly or whatever, you know, with EMC and HP and IBM and everybody else to make sure that, you know, customers had some amount of choice there, right? NetApp, I should put NetApp in there. You know, to think that you can do this white box where you're going to try to bite the ankles off Oracle storage business. I mean, what's going to happen is the foot's going to slip off the pedal and it's going to crush you.
Yeah.
Well, Oracle's going to be all cloud in 5 years, right?
They missed that one. You know what as well, though? I've heard of several Oracle customers that have like come a cropper to the licensing deal at Oracle. And as a sweetener, Oracle have come and said, look, you owe us all this money really on licensing, but rather than pay us that, what if you buy like a couple of exagrids from us and we'll wipe the slate clean on the licensing front and you've got yourself as part of the deal a shiny new like flash database engine there. So they're even competing with stuff like that, you know, where I'm not saying customers get Oracle Exagrid for free because they don't, but at the same time, they're kind of not paying for it because that would have been a license fee they'd have to pay anyway. So I don't know. This like seems pocked with like landmines. Yeah, FlashGrid. Not sure that we'll be talking about them again in the future. Who knows, though? You never know. Maybe they take the world by storm. You know what, actually? I talked to a company called Portworks when I was at DockerCon in Barcelona in November last year. And they're kind of like this software-defined storage company, but that focus on Docker. And I was like saying to them, well, you know what? It's kind of cool what they're doing. I do like them and the people I spoke to there. But why aren't you going after the wider software-defined storage market? And they were saying, oh, well, you know, the technology obviously will do that. But in the early days when we don't have loads of cash and we don't have loads of engineers, we want to just focus on, but for them, it's Docker-focused storage, right? And maybe it's just a case that for FlashGrid, the product that they're, you know, the overall product they're developing could be a general-purpose software-defined storage solution and may well be in the future if they live long enough, right? But on day one, for whatever reason, they've chosen to go the route that they've gone in. But maybe, I don't know, in the long-term business plan, they see it as being more than just this. Who knows? We should call this the show of speculation because that's what we've done all show.
That's all we're doing.
Never mind. Last item that we've got on the cards then. Docker acquires Conductant, a company I've never heard of, right? So I did search them. They were founded in 2015. They've not come out of stealth, don't believe. So there's nothing in Crunchbase about how much money they've raised or anything like that. But to your point earlier, Mark, you were saying a lot of these acquisitions tend to be for intellectual property and for talent, right? So it seems like there's probably only a handful of people at Conductant, and that's not gospel, right? I have no idea, right? But they're a small company in stealth, so they're not going to be big. But they did mention three people that, like, you know, were at the likes of Google on the Borg project there, and then helping deliver services that helped Twitter deliver microservices at scale and stuff like that. So it looks like Docker have acquired this company probably for pennies to acquire talent. Certainly not customer base, right? But it looks like they're trying to go for uber scale. And, you know, we've talked tons in the past about, I guess, revenue for companies in the container ecosystem isn't going to come from like the core Docker engine and stuff like that. That stuff's out there for free already these days. And, you know, you're not going to be generating a business off of that. But it's when it comes to orchestration where the money's going to be made. And so in that space, Docker have got Swarm, which is, you know, is a solid orchestration platform, clustering tool, but probably doesn't scale as well as something like a Kubernetes or a Mesosphere.
What's the name of this company?
Conductant.
Conductant. What's, how much of that stuff do you think was open? It's not open source. Was it based on?
No, it is. Yeah. So it's based on Apache Aurora, I believe, which was open source like a couple of years ago. So again, you know, we talked about this a lot as well, haven't we? It's not necessarily so easy to turn a profit off of open sourced technologies. But when you get to the kind of scale that it seems this is aimed at, that maybe companies would, I don't know, pay for support.
I think what makes sense to look at this is not so much from the Docker side as why would Docker do it, but from the Conductant side, why would Conductant want to be acquired, right? And if you look at this deal from that way, it makes a little more sense, right? If Conductant had open source technology and they're looking at competing with Kubernetes and Mesosphere, and it looks like it's going to be pretty hard to make a buck doing it, at some point you just say, you know what, let's just get out early before we go too big, right? At some point, you know, they've got a pool of money and maybe they've drawn down on it and they had to look at getting more, they had to look at getting funding, you know, and all this stuff. And it might just be, you know what, easier to just sell now than to actually try to make this thing go big and cave in and all that, right? It might have just been the fastest, easiest path to take this little startup and sell it quickly. There's a lot of that goes on in software, right? A lot of stuff sells fast, and it looks like this was another example of it.
Quite often in these acquisitions, the minds behind the startup that's been acquired tend not to stick around for too long, yeah? They have the kind of minds that want to innovate and want to start up and do that kind of thing perpetually, right? Well, we do still see Docker Inc. as a startup here, right? I don't know what they've got, like 200, 250 full-time employees probably. It'd be interesting to see how long the founders from Conductant stick around. And that would, in my opinion at least, you know, give some kind of impression as to how things are internally at Docker. Is it still operating like a startup? Are they still hungry? Are they still innovating? Are they still wanting to change the world, yeah? Or are they quickly evolving into... Because let's be fair, right? I think in... Well, Docker is not quite 3 years old yet, and this is probably like the fifth acquisition that they've made. So they're acquiring at a decent clip, okay? And how long is it before they start to become less cool? I don't know. Is that even relevant?
Yeah, but the guys that started Conductant, right, came from Google and Twitter and places like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They so it's not like they were coming. It doesn't look like they were serial entrepreneurs. It looks like they were, you know, software people looking at trying to figure out how to, and especially at Twitter, make microservices go huge.
Yes, yes, right? Yeah.
And so, okay, yeah, that was a Twitter job. And before that, working at Borg at Google, you know, that was a Google job. It doesn't look like they're serial entrepreneurs. It looks like they're just software guys that are around this stuff, and they had a good idea and they decided, hey, let's try this. And then, you know, you get, like I say, you get to a point, it's like, do we take on a bunch of money or do we take this technology and just put it somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the idea all along was to try to sell it to Docker.
Yeah, sure.
And if it was, good for them.
Yeah, congrats. Great for them. So let's switch on to Hot or Not to finish off the show. You know what, since we had like honestly so much great feedback from last week's Hot or Not on the Samsung Welt, we're going to do what we should never do, and we're going to try and recreate it, and we're probably going to fail epically, right? So the Welt was kind of another, like, what did you call it, Lauren? Like a personal fitness or...
Yeah, I mean, it's basically an activity tracker.
That's right, yeah. We've got watches, we've got belts now. If you were to come out with a new activity tracker, what would it be? Or even if it's not an activity tracker, what should we be tracking in our daily lives, yeah? So the question this week is simple. Is like the whole wide idea of Fitbit and all of this like activity tracker and tracking our diets and jazz like that, is that whole idea hot or is it not? And I'm going to throw the question to you first, Lauren. And it was so awesome. And to be fair, you're probably the fittest person on the podcast. And
oh God, no!
no Joe pressure. Might be,
yeah.
We got with Joe, your boss, on. We don't really want to be talking about how many beers you had before the podcast this week.
Joe's bought me the beers.
That's what we need. We need something to track how many beers you sink in every day. How many units you consume in a day? That's what you need.
I don't want to see those numbers.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? And we should sell it to corporations to keep track of their employees. And Lauren, pink slip time for you.
If Joe saw my numbers, he'd rehire me again if he could.
Is that right?
My boss just tracks that based on my smell throughout the day.
How close he can get to you without getting a whiff.
Exactly.
And when you go to talk to him, do I kind of look away so the breath moves in another direction?
No, I do the hand over the mouth like somebody laughing and trying to be shy.
Smell the glove.
Geisha look.
Joe, you're keeping like the local mint company in business. What's with that?
You know, you got to do something to keep the shakes away throughout the day.
Maybe that's, you need a proximity tracker to know how close you should get to the person that's, you know, but imbibing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the device I want, is a device that sits, you know, maybe on my collar and tells me when my breath shows alcohol way too much, so I know to go get that man.
There's a notification. It buzzes, but you wouldn't be able to decipher the buzzing from the shaking. So you'd need a noise alert.
Hey, we have this thing over here in Europe where if you're going to travel, at least from the UK to France, you need to have your own breathalyzer in the car. Well, you actually need to have two legally. So before you go to France, if you're going to be driving your car in France, you've got to take two breathalyzers. And the premise of it is that in case the local police pull you over there, rather than the local police force having to pay for breathalyzer kits, you have to have paid for it yourself, right?
What? I know. This is just unfathomable.
Let's just alienate our two French listeners.
Why not just take, you know, like a little lab kit with you so you can do the blood work too?
I know.
Right. Or what else? Bring a billy club and a gun so you can arrest yourself too. I guess they don't have guns though in France.
No, they don't.
So if you're bringing your own kit, then you just make it so that it doesn't ever go over the legal BAC.
Yeah, no, I mean, of course, it's got to be like sealed and packaged, and it can't be more than a year old. So like the one that we had that we took last year, we've got to buy a new one. We can't use that. So yeah, anyway, never mind. So what about, okay, the next iteration of the Apple Watch, the boss is coming, right? Instead of you just make it look like you're looking at the time, you do a quick cheeky breath onto the watch, and it's got a gauge, it's got an app, green, amber, red.
There's like a green smoke that goes over the watch face.
Yes.
What happens if you pass it under your armpit?
For you, Mark, that would probably always be red. So back on track, do you, Lauren, think that the whole thing is hot, or do you think it's not?
We have so many other now. I mean, the Fitbits, the Fluxes, from every different vendor, and there's always new ones coming out. I think certainly it's going to die down. And I have to admit, like, when I see a grown man wearing a Fitbit, I judge a little bit. Like, and I know that's kind of sexist, but...
And how do you judge them? Do you think they're, like, cool?
Yep, that's what I meant.
Hey, can I ask you, do you see like a particular type of grown man that wears them, like a particular shape or a particular sexual orientation or anything that you can deduce?
Not anymore. Honestly, like all dudes wear them now.
All
but
dudes wear them. All right.
Yeah.
Does John wear one?
I'm not. I actually had a funny experience with the data that you're showing that you don't realize. I had one of them at one point that I wore, and a married couple that were friends of mine. We shared, I guess, the activity information. And the interesting thing was, by just watching daily activity, I could tell that the husband woke up and had some happy time every morning at the same time. Nice. The wife wasn't involved because she was still bed asleep, according to the band.
Oh, brilliant.
And you can just infer it based on the data. It's amazing. It's a lot of fun.
So I think what we're coming to a consensus on here is that, like, the stuff that maybe they were originally intended for, like to count your calories or how many steps or what your heart rate is, it is not where the real magic for these devices is, right? It's the, you can find out a little bit of happy time being going on there with at least somebody that's not the wife. Maybe it's with yourself, of course. Yes, never mind. Or if it's like the next gen that we're talking about where, you know, say, quick little cheeky breath onto the watch tells you whether you're going to be in trouble from the boss or something. I don't know. Maybe, is that the future? Are we missing the point here, thinking it's all about helping us live healthier lives when really it's not? It's about us like catching our cheating spouses or finding out what the neighbors are up to, stuff like that. Is that what it's for?
So what might help me is if the watch or Fitbit or whatever just give me like a severe jolt every time I put a chili cheese fry in my mouth, you know?
Wouldn't you be shaking all day then? Jolt after
Lauren, I could just record a keychain for you with my voice screaming at you. You can just press the button anytime you want the cheese fries.
Hey, totally different tactic there. It's Gabriel's birthday today.
No wonder he's not on.
Maybe tomorrow for you guys, actually, because obviously it's just turned to Thursday for me, and it's just popped up in my calendar. Today is Gabriel Chapman's birthday.
Maybe. I guess he's starting the party early.
We should get him a Fitbit.
Yeah, he's out celebrating.
And some Velcro.
Yes.
And make sure we're friends with him in the Fitbit.
Oh, yeah, Fitbit friends. I guess that'll be the next thing, right? So you can follow all your friends and what they did on Fitbit.
They're,
I mean, or did they already do this? They do
that's
this.
That's what so Joe's talking about, how he could see his friends. Yeah.
Honestly, there are so many.
So the husband at 8 a.m. every morning went from dead asleep to extremely active while the wife was still dead asleep.
And you know,
I just figured that's husband and wife stuff. I didn't think this was like Snapchat, Fitbit.
No, you can friend anybody.
Honestly, if we thought that like Facebook ruined so many relationships, this has the potential to destroy so many more. Oh dear.
Has Facebook ruined relationships?
Well, as in, like, you know, quite a lot of people ended up hooking up with old, you know, childhood sweethearts and stuff on the sly. And, well, I know a few people that did that.
I heard a stat the other day that Facebook is now mentioned in over 50% of divorce hearings.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe now that's hot.
Yeah, that is hot.
Facebook's hot again.
And you know what? My wife is on Facebook all the time. Should I be worried?
You gotta get her a Fitbit, Nigel.
Yeah. You need to do the Facebook Fitbit integration.
Yeah.
Or a welt.
Or a welt.
Or yes.
That sounds wrong. I'm gonna get my wife a welt. That does not sound good, does it? So on that, I think we probably ought to wrap the show up before I give my wife grounds for divorce. Do want to thank you, Joe. Thanks for being on the show. We really do appreciate it. Just give us a quick reminder of who you are, where you blog, tweet, stuff like that.
So thanks for having me on. You can find me online at definethecloud.net or on Twitter at @JayOnasik.
Cool. Thanks again, Joe, for being on. Mark, Lauren, as always, a pleasure. Gabriel, happy birthday. And Rickatron, hope you're back next week, fella. And again, obviously, for listeners, what it's all about. Thanks for tuning in. And you know what? Any feedback that we do get for you guys, we absolutely love it and we really appreciate it. Even if you're telling us, oh, hey, last week's episode wasn't so great, tell us why. Yeah, we're probably not going to fix it, but you never know. We do appreciate you listening, though. Thank you.